I'm Cynthia Molavita, and this is the session on globalization and the quest for sources of spiritual and moral power to respond faithfully to globalization. So as I said yesterday, if that's where you want to be, stay, and if it's not, this is a good time to leave. I would like a sense of how many people here today were also at yesterday's session. Could I just see a show of hands? How many people were not here yesterday? Okay, a goodly number. So I'll do a very, very, very brief recap, and then we'll move on to today's material. We are spending these five sessions together exploring, digging more deeply into a contradiction that I, at least, find to be enormously disturbing, terrifying, when I take it seriously. And the contradiction is this. We are called to love neighbor as self. We are called to receive God's love, to love God, and to love others. Today we know that others includes the very earth itself. This is why we exist. This is why we're here. And on the other hand, and in stark contrast to that calling and that gift and that reason for being, we live according to global economic structures that spell death for many people on earth and that are destroying many of Earth's life support systems. For some reasons, we're in bondage. We comply with, we acquiesce to ways of economic life that are not sustainable and that are terribly exploitative. So this is the contradiction that I'm holding up for our struggle and our inquiry in these sessions together. In order to lay the groundwork or set the stage, if you will, I'll read just three quotes that say in short form what I would say if we had days on end about the ways in which global economic structures are exploitative and destructive of the earth. Here then, a statement by a third world economist, Martin Kaur. Via their domination of the new global systems of trade and finance, the industrial countries have rapidly sucked out forest, mineral, and metal resources from the third world and used its land and labor resources. The industrial nations, approximately one-fifth of the world's population, use up four-fifths of the world's resources, mostly for making luxury items. Here then, words from the State of the World report, the annual report that comes out annually that's used around the world. Biodiversity is the basis for our existence. However, like the dinosaurs 65 million years ago, humanity now finds itself in the midst of a mass extinction, a global evolutionary convulsion with few parallels in the entire history of life. Most estimates are that at least 1,000 species are lost per year. But unlike the dinosaurs, we are not simply the contemporaries of a mass extinction, we are the reason for it. Reversing this trend calls for a restructuring of the global economy. It calls for replacing our consumer culture with a less materialistic and far more environmentally literate way of life. The fate of our children depends upon it in ways we can barely begin to conceive. And finally, a brief statement from a United Nations report, and I read this one yesterday. Three-fifths of people in developing countries have no access to basic sanitation. Almost one-third are without safe drinking water. Installation of water and sanitation for all would cost $9 billion. $11 billion is spent annually on ice cream in Europe. $8 billion is spent annually for cosmetics in the U.S. alone. Basic health care and nutrition would cost $13 billion. $17 billion a year is spent on pet food in Europe and in the United States. In my opinion, to face this contradiction and take it seriously is an act of tremendous courage. It's much easier to ignore it. I think it's an act of rage, it's an act of grief, it's an act of faith to say that we live in this contradiction, and how can we, by calling upon our faith, work our way out of it. So that's really to set the stage for what we're trying to work on in these few hours together. I will ask that we work on two main questions, and the questions are these. First, if the prevailing model of globalization indeed brutalizes the poor and jeopardizes Earth's regenerative capacities, why do we acquiesce to that model without declaring it an affront to faith in Jesus Christ? Why do we just go along with it? Secondly, where in our Christian faith traditions are we offered hope and the moral, spiritual power to resist, to revision, and to rebuild economic ways that nurture communities and the Earth community according to justice and compassion for generations to come? It seems to me that humanity is called upon today to dig into all of the great faith traditions, to understand where we can find the spiritual and the moral power to reshape the relationship between our species and the Earth, and to reshape the relationship between the haves and the have-nots within our species. Yesterday, we did a kind of overview of the whole series, and we did a beginning look at what are some of the defining dynamics of economic globalization. What do we mean when we say economic globalization? I'm not going to redo that, because obviously we'd be redoing yesterday's session, but I'd be happy to talk about that with people at another time. What we intend to do tomorrow, well, today, is to look at this first question. What are some of the reasons that we agree with this state of affairs? In the next 3 days, we'll be drawing upon faith forebearers, ancestors in our faith tradition, in search of moral, spiritual power for resistance. And the ways in which we'll do that is tomorrow, and the main faith forebearer that I will have us draw upon is Martin Luther. Tomorrow we're going to spend some time looking at how it is that people today, in the year 2000, can with integrity really draw upon a pre-modern figure or figures for moral guidance regarding issues that they never even dreamt of, issues that were off the screen for their reality. How can we draw upon them? How can we draw upon, for moral guidance, a figure like Martin Luther, who demonized Jews and Anabaptists and whatever? There are many complexities when we say, I'm going to draw upon Martin Luther or anyone else in our faith tradition. So we're going to look at those complexities and say how. The next day, we will draw upon Martin Luther and look at some of his incredibly radical economic ethics, startling economic ethics. And then in the final day, we'll look to Luther again for understandings of the notion that Jesus Christ lives in us and actually loves others in us. And where do we find moral power in that? So again, that's a bit of an overview just to situate the discussion for today. Before we go on, are there questions, clarifying questions, concerns that should be raised in order to move forward for today? Okay, good. That'll help us cover all the territory in 1 hour. I would like us to consider just, again, the question is, why do we acquiesce? Why do we comply? And there are many reasons, a myriad of reasons. We could spend days and days and days. I'm going to simply suggest one set of dynamics that feeds our complicity and disempowers our moral capacity to respond faithfully to the globalizing economy. Hear the words of Francis Morlepay. Does anyone know Francis Morlepay, the author of Food First, Diet for a Small Planet? A brief paragraph from her, and I'm agreeing with this statement of hers. She asks, what could be powerful enough to allow us to tolerate, to accept, to acquiesce to millions of silent deaths by hunger every year? What could possibly explain our ability to condone such a status quo? I have finally come to believe that there is only one thing powerful enough. It is the power of ideas. The ideas we hold about ourselves and our relationships to one another. It is these ideas that allow us to condone or even to support with tax dollars that which we as individuals abhor, and somehow to tolerate the discomforting contrast. End of quote. I refer to these sets of ideas that we hold as an ideology, and the word ideology has many connotations. I use it here to mean a worldview, a way of organizing how people and societies supposedly ought to perceive the world and make sense of it. An ideology shapes the questions we ask, the answers we pose. It shapes our notions of who we are, who God is, how we stand in relationship to the rest of the earth, a set of overall belief systems and worldviews. I'm convinced that we live as part of an overall ideology that I refer to as free market ideology. I think it is a worldview or an ideology that prevents us from knowing who we are. From knowing who we are as bearers of divine love for this earth. I am convinced that if we do not see clearly the ideologies that shape us, the belief systems that we hold, as citizens of the United States, as people of relative economic privilege in the United States, if we do not see clearly these ideologies, then they continue to shape us in ways that we don't fully understand. They continue to form us and to malform us into people who can accept tremendous injustice without resisting it. So it seems to me that it's very important for us to say, what are the belief systems? What are the things that we hold to be true, even without knowing it, that shape who we are on this earth? And that may stand in grand contradiction to what we claim to believe as Christian people. I'd like to suggest, I'd like to say, maybe parenthetically, that we have the constraints of an hour here, and I would much prefer to stop saying anything at this point and ask you to tell me what beliefs you think we hold. If the statements that I read are true about the destruction of Earth's biodiversity and capacity to sustain life, if it's true that our people is sucking the resources out of the continents of the Earth and from other people, what do we believe that enables us to agree to that? But I'm not really going to open that up as a question right now, because I'd like to throw out some ideas that I've been working on and then open it up for question, if that's all right. Consider a few of what I call market myths, and I'll name four market myths. I think I've written them up here. I'm going to identify what I consider to be four market myths or parts of free market ideology that shape us, and then we'll dig into one of them. I think we'll be digging into the first one, and next week we'll spend time on the second and third. Allow me to read briefly from something else that I've written that explains these. The first is this. And this is where we left off yesterday, and it also responds very much to a question that was asked by someone yesterday. I don't remember who asked the question. The first is this. It's an economic myth, assumed, pretty much uncritically assumed, until the recent financial crises in the Near East. The myth is that free markets will solve humanity's problems by creating economic growth and wealth, which will trickle down to benefit everyone. I'm holding that up as the first of many market myths. The second is what I call a moral anthropology, or a sense of who we are as human beings. Human beings are essentially autonomous individuals with unalienable rights to pursue self-interest, rather than beings in community with a moral obligation to serve the common good. We are essentially competitive rather than cooperative, consumeristic rather than spiritual. In economic life, we are motivated almost entirely by self-interest, measured by personal financial gain. Those who own the most and consume the most are the most valued human beings. I'm calling that a myth because that is one of the presuppositions underlying neoclassical economic theory, that individuals are motivated primarily by personal economic gain and are essentially autonomous individuals rather than intricate pieces of an organic web of life that includes human beings and all other creatures on Earth. That's the second myth. The third is a set of presuppositions about freedom that links human freedom to market freedom. And this is a big, big hunk, and there are many presuppositions about freedom. I'll name two of them. And by presuppositions, I mean things that we just sort of uncritically assume to be true as a society. The first is that the human species is free to use Earth's resources for the sake of profit. This freedom really extends to people with the economic resources to buy the Earth's resources, but that is a human freedom. It's grounded in our biblical interpretations, go forth and dominate, dominion theology, but that is one of our myths of freedom. A second myth of freedom is that free markets, that is free trade and investment, and freedom of choice in buying things and accumulating wealth, enhances human freedom and is a necessary condition for human freedom to flourish. To obstruct the freedom of the market is to obstruct human freedom. I'll suggest that that set of presuppositions and many others that go with it about freedom are one of the elements of our underlying market ideology. And the fourth is that the current form of globalization, corporate and finance-driven globalization, is inevitable. There are no, you know, Margaret Thatcher's famous statement, Tina, there is no alternative, is something that we presuppose to be true about global capitalism today. I'll hold those up there. We can open it up for discussion towards the end about the bottom three, and let's focus on the first one, and that is the economic theory about growth. The key economic argument underlying the dominant model of globalization today, and that is globalization centered on free trade and investment, is this. Freedom of trade and investment from regulation creates economic growth, which does trickle down to benefit all people. That is, choices freely made by people to buy and sell in the self-regulating market will result in growth, which will benefit humanity. Growth of economies in the third world will benefit all people in the third world. Supporters of globalization in all venues appeal to this theory. This is really the fundamental argument. If you, in public discourse in most places, question globalization as we know it today, the response that you will get is that this form of globalization is growth creating. It's wealth creating, and that is going to serve the well-being of poor people throughout the world. It's very important that people who have concerns about the global economy take a look at that myth. See where it really holds truth and see where it is faulty. Before we do that, I think we need to take a moment to look at what growth means, because growth is the big word in this theory. Growth is defined in fairly concise terms in two ways. Measured by GDP, it is an increase in the amount of goods and services paid for in a nation. Measured in per capita income or wealth, it's an increase in the average. So if income in the U.S. is increasing per capita income, it's an increase in the average per capita income. So growth essentially means rising national income, wealth, production, and consumption. That's what we're talking about when people speak of growth in the economy. So you'll note that the theory is really a twofold theory. It has two parts to it. The first part is that free markets, free trade and investment will generate growth. And the second clause of the theory is that growth will benefit everyone. Just take a moment to think about those. Where do you think they hold truth and where do they bear falsehood? Any thoughts on that? Yes.
Well, it seemed to me the first part tends to be true. The second part, we tend to forget that if there is growth, if there is change, if there is this improvement, what we don't want to say and what where I think it's wrong or overshadows it or overglosses it, that they're going to be winners and losers. Mm-hmm. If I sell my apples better than you, I win and you lose. Mm-hmm. So by my being able to ship those apples to all the continents, I should win more. And if you don't change, then you're going to lose more. So the implied assumption in the second part is, well, of course, everyone will change, and of course, everyone will strive to do the best. And that's not the real world. Some are incapable of it. Some don't want to. Some don't have the education. Some don't have the political system. That is, I think, where it all falls down. Okay. The assumption does not hold true that everyone buys into this.
Okay. So that's one comment on the truth of the first clause in the theory and a problem with the second clause. Other thoughts on that? Yes.
I think if you look at Ireland today, it's fastest. The GDP is growing the fastest of any country in Europe. It's also the freest economically. And it's working.
So what you would say there is Ireland is an example where the free economy is promoting growth, part one of the theory, and where, from your understanding thus far, that growth is benefiting many people.
Yes, I think it's pretty obvious if you go to Ireland.
Okay.
Just one other item. But it's not completely free in Ireland. They still have controls.
So it would be very, very interesting to note what controls. That's a key question. Yes.
You said something about the trickle-down theory, too. The other European countries are helping Ireland out, giving them money to help to stimulate their economy. So why are they giving them money? Probably because they have some extra money to give away. So that's helping them out. So that would hit us on a trickle-down.
Okay, good.
I have a question.
Yes.
In Ireland, is this government, what kind of government is that? Is that somewhat of a socialistic?
No, it's very it's very free market economy. The especially the computer companies are moving into Ireland. And the main reason is that most of Europe, when you hire somebody, you hire them basically for life. And so nobody's hiring people. In Ireland, they don't have that.
Ireland's it's a fascinating story because it's got, I think your myth is often not true. And I think usually it fails. I'm not sure it often fails because of economic policy. I think frequently it fails because of local government policy. Ireland, I think, the international companies started setting up call centers and other sort of low-cost labor centers in Cork and other places 10, 15, 20 years ago because labor was cheaper. Government has been, by and large, quite free and has allowed the laborers to get the benefit. We can argue about whether or not they were paid that enough. And there are real issues about whether or not putting a call center there rather than in Omaha or Sioux Falls, what that does to American workers. And those are sort of real issues. But ultimately, that beget an increasingly educated and experienced workforce in Ireland and brought more and more high-level tech work in Ireland, more and more sort of computer production and other things. And that's really taken off into a lot of startup entities and a very vibrant sort of healthy economy. But the government did not get in the way.
I am torn, a bit torn, because I'd really like to engage the discussion of Ireland. And I also would like to go on and lay out a little bit more information. And I think I'll do the latter. And then maybe we can hold up Ireland and what is working and what's going on there, and other countries with similar or dissimilar experiences, and hope to make time to dig into more of that towards the end. Ireland is one we should look at. China is one we should look at because of the incredible growth in the economy in China. The U.S. is one we should look at because of the growing economy here. So let's just kind of hold those up and bring them in discussion towards the end. I would say, in response to my own question, that the first clause of the theory is really true, and that's part of what two of the statements on Ireland were saying also, that freedom, liberalized markets that are relatively unregulated by state intervention at any level, be it national or international, do result in growth, at least in the short term, meaning 10 to 20 years short term. Growth is definitely a result of market freedom. I would say that the second part of the clause, that growth implies or means economic benefit for all, is a very, very dangerous and misleading presupposition. And I'd like to look at a few ways in which it is. I'm not saying that it's always wrong. I'm not saying that growth always doesn't benefit everyone. What I'm saying is that it's a misleading and distracting and inaccurate measure of well-being for everyone. If we suppose that growth means benefit for everyone and will trickle down, there are problems to that, is what I'd like to suggest. And I'd like to offer four problems with that theory. I think that it's crucial, absolutely crucial, to understand this theory and to understand where it misleads us into agreeing to the economy as it is. The first problem with the theory is that it fails to account for the social and ecological costs of growth, and it fails to distinguish between constructive and destructive economic activity. That's going to be the first problem. The second is going to be that it fails to account. Shall I write these down?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that quickly. And then we're going to dig into each one of them, one by one. But very quickly, just to name the four. And these are problems with the second part of the theory. It fails to account for the social and ecological costs. Second, it fails to account for the limits of the planet. Third, it doesn't take into account income distribution. We'll say income and wealth distribution. And the fourth, I'll just write down as a key, is the switch from using GNP, gross national product, to gross domestic product. And some of the deceptive implications of the fact that we now use on an international basis gross domestic product and not gross national product. So those are the four problems that we'll look at with the theory of growth. The first one, that it fails to account for the social and ecological costs and to distinguish between destructive and constructive economic activity. Basically, there are many pieces of this. One is that the more commodity intensive a lifestyle is, the more it contributes to growth. Now, you remember that in the first statement we talked about that for the destruction of Earth's life systems to stop, we need to be a less consumptive species, or rather, a less consumptive part of the species, the North Atlantic part of the world. Consumption, and I think many of us are familiar with this, many of us people at Holden Village and all, are familiar with the dangers of our consumption-oriented economy, with extremely consumptive lifestyles. So we're in a day and age when people of good conscience are trying to consume less. We recycle. What else do we do to consume less? We use things longer, we try to drive less, use less gas, ride our bikes. We're aware that increasing consumption isn't going to be good for the earth. But growth figures, according to growth figures, the more we consume, the more growth there is in our economy. Secondly, growth counts as progress, counts as benefit, the use of and non-replacement of natural resources. A former president of the World Bank put it this way. Growth figures are generally used without the caveat that they represent an income that cannot be sustained. They ignore the degradation of the natural resource base and view the sale of non-renewable resources as income. So is that clear, or shall I say more about that? If we
repeat it, sure.
Growth figures are generally used without the caveat that they represent an income that cannot be sustained. They ignore the degradation of the natural resource base and view the sale of non-renewable resources entirely as income.
Can you give an example?
An example, thank you. China's growth has been incredible. I think it's the highest growing economy in the world in the last 5 years or so. Other data has gone in to look at what is happening to the use of natural resources in China and the implications of it. The coal burning, the public health disaster amongst Chinese people of the rampant use of fossil fuels has been disastrous. The clean water supply and soil supply in China is rapidly being depleted. In this 5 to 10 year period, growth is marvelous in China. What's going to happen 10 years down the road in China when resources are depleted or when use of resources is damaging public health? What happens, the Philippines are being mined, rapidly mined. Growth rates go up when mining is done. What happens when the resources are depleted? Now, if we're not looking for 10 years down the road, but 20 to 30 years down the road. But growth figures take no account for that. The third issue with growth, with the failure to account for social and ecological costs, is that family and community and health breakdown counts as growth. There's no one who, and remember, growth is good in this theory. There's no one who contributes more to the growth of our economy than a terminally ill cancer patient who is going through a brutally contested divorce and whose kids have two luxury cars that they have repeated minor accidents in. You know, the more we sell, the more they market to our kids, and you know, 13 and under are the highest are the target of marketing today. The more they sell to our kids violent video games, massive amounts of junk food, designer clothes for preschool kids, the more they do that, the more our economy grows. Do you follow what I'm saying there? The breakdown of the things that build for community, the paying for those count as growth. If we drive luxury cars that eat a lot of gas, and we have repeated accidents, and we go into lawsuits about them, we're contributing to the growth of our economy.
Okay.
Yes?
I understand why parents would put people into two different households, and that would be growth.
Yes.
But why cancer?
Because cancer, and I'm using that in no way degrading or criticizing. I'm using it to say that health breakdown that is very expensive.
Okay.
If someone is going through repeated treatments, the consumption of that healthcare. I'm not saying that as a critique of healthcare. I'm saying that horribly painful health breakdown grows our economy.
And then you get three new oncologists into the community, and that shows that you're having a healthy, growing economy.
Right.
That's just one more aspect of a growing healthcare system.
Right, right. And again, you understand this is descriptive, not critical of healthcare, but yes, that's a very good example of it.
Cynthia?
Yes.
On the other side of that, yes, in terms of some ethical papers that I've read in that, but to show again how the whole notion of commodity and economics drives this issue with regard to the terminally ill,
yes,
there are some folks who now are arguing that, for example, a terminally ill person has a duty to die. And the basic reasons that they give for that are economic, because like you say, a terminally ill person, a cancer, lots of specialists in that. But they say if, for example, that person comes home, that puts the, then maybe if it's a family with two people working, one person has to go out of the market in order to take care of for this parent or whatever. And so again, they crunch the numbers and find out that it's economically detrimental. And if you want to be a good citizen, if you're terminally ill, you should die so that the rest of your family can be a good economic viable consumer.
Okay.
So the interesting thing is it cuts both ways, but whichever way you look at it, economics still drives the debate.
Yes, and that is a good point. It also opens up like a whole nother set of moral issues that we could debate. And I don't want to be misread at all in saying I am not at this advocating that people don't seek health care because it's using economic resources. I am simply holding up for you the ambiguity in this notion that growth is necessarily an indication of economic and community well-being. But that we should make a lot of bookmarks to come back to. That's another bookmark to come back to. In short, and let me call upon you in just 1 minute, in short, these things that I've said about the first point up there are expressed by John Cobb. I don't know if you know John Cobb, an economic Christian ethicist. He says, to use growth as a measure of progress is perverse. The breakdown of families and communities and the depletion of the environment is masked as progress. In the U.S., divorces, new prison construction, conspicuous consumption of environmentally destructive products, and the sale of war games all count as growth. So that's the first little piece here. You had a question, a comment.
Actually, I didn't. I was just going to slap the fly.
Oh, you were going to slap the fly. Well, that's a nice little one. Great. So here's this is one way of calling into question growth. A second, and that's the second point up here, is that we fail to note that there are limits imposed by living on a planet, the planet Earth. Economic growth is not constrained. The theory is that economic growth is not constrained by the limits of the planet. That false theory has been, we have assumed that economic growth is infinite. I'd like to read for you a statement by Henry Morgenthau, who was the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury at the opening of the Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF. He calls for embracing the, quote, elementary economic axiom that prosperity has no fixed limits. In contrast, here the economist Herman Daly, formerly chief economist of the World Bank, he and others, Larry Rasmussen, the Christian ethicist, and many others have pointed out that the human economy is part of a much larger economy of the planet. And environmental limits in both renewable and non-renewable resources have been so exceeded that continued growth serves now to further destroy the Earth's capacity to regenerate. Economic growth, the aim and primary promise of globalization, has collided with the Earth's natural limits. A growth-oriented economy is not sustainable. End of quote. Yet, according to free market theory, economic growth will bring all people to a state of prosperity as defined by U.S. middle-class consumption standards. So that's a second problem, a second weakness in our theory that growth is what we ought to seek and it will benefit everyone. A third weakness is that growth theory does not take into account, and that's the third one up here, income and wealth distribution. Consider, for example, the United States. Economists say that the economy of the U.S. has been never better. We have been, our GDP has been on the increase for the last 50 years. Yet, strangely enough, we have increasing homelessness. In my city, there are increasing numbers of kids. My kids' middle school has the school for homeless kids, middle school kids. Our university district is full of homeless teenagers. There are increasing numbers of people who can't afford health care. Increasing numbers of kids going to schools so decrepit and run down that they have to have their small reading groups in bathroom stalls. That's one of the schools in Washington, D.C. How is it that there are 32 kids in a classroom of 8-year-olds in schools? People can't afford health care. In an economy that's growing magnificently, you have to wonder, what's the story there? And one of the reasons is that growth figures, the figures that indicate economic growth, are usually based on averages. Average income, if you have 10 people and one of them becomes a billionaire and seven of them have decreasing income, growth is still going to go up if you're going by averages, because that billionaire is going to take the growth of the 10 way up. Again, I read to you from a brief booklet by a group called United for a Fair Economy. The average American household, according to latest figures, is now worth a whopping $176,000, a stunning 22% increase since 83. Now hear that, according to growth figures, a 22% increase, $176,000. The typical household, that is the median household, the one in the middle of numbers, has a measly $11,700 to its name, a sum that is actually down 10% since 1989. So in those figures, we see the deception. The fourth problem with growth figures.
Could you read that again, please?
Sure. The average American household, according to the latest, the year is 1999, but this was 1998. The average American household, according to the latest figures, is now worth a whopping $176,000, counting everything except home ownership, a stunning 22.2% increase since 1983. The typical household, or the median household, has a measly $11,700 to its name, a sum that is actually down 10% since 1989.
Are they valuing the net worth of each, or the price of the house?
Oh, no. This is excluding, counting everything except home ownership.
This is wealth, not income.
Is that income per year, or just
wealth?
That's wealth.
That's assets excluding your home.
It's assets excluding your home, right. Now, we know part of the difference there between the 176 and the 11 is explained by the enormously increasing wealth of a few. The three wealthiest people on this planet are worth more than, it's either 48, the total of the people in 48 countries of the planet. Understand that three people are worth more than the combined wealth of the people in 48 different nations. There's a lot of data explaining that. It's UN data. There has been magnificent increase in the wealth of a few. In the United States, the average CEO of a large corporation makes 419 times the amount of the average manufacturing worker. That's not even to say the average McDonald's worker or janitorial worker. So you see, that difference that gap and the enormous increase in income of a few is a deceptive, makes growth a deceptive indicator. There's an additional problem with growth, and we'll go to the fourth one, and then we'll come back to some of these. That is that some years ago, it's within the last 10 to 15 years, and I can't tell you exactly which year, on an international basis, we went from using GNP to GDP. GNP was gross national product, GDP is gross domestic product. It was understood in the public discourse as a semantic change, an inconsequential change. But it's a very important change that again mystifies growth. And the change is this. When a global corporate country, and say, establishes a factory and starts producing things and creating economic growth, under GNP, the growth that was created, the wealth that was created by that factory in that third world country was attributed to the host, the country from which the corporation came. Say the corporation was a US-based country and it went into Guatemala and it made a factory and it produced a bunch of stuff and that created growth. That income growth would be attributed to the US. Under GDP, that growth is attributed to Guatemalan growth. All that money could be expatriated. The vast portion of the money made in that factory could not stay in Guatemala, but could come out of Guatemala. But the growth is still attributed to Guatemala, which means that it looks like the Guatemalan economy is growing because that factory, that textile factory, say, has come into Guatemala. But in fact, all the income can go out, and the Guatemalan economy is not necessarily benefiting from that. Did you follow that? It's kind of a complex thing, but it's a way of digging into, demystifying, unearthing why we can have such incredible growth around the world with increasing poverty around the world. And one of those factors is this use of GDP. Take a little bit of time now. How much time do we have? We have about a little less than 15 minutes. Questions, concerns, insights regarding this demystification of growth. And again, to remind you, I am doing this. I am saying that we have problems with growth for the purpose of us understanding why we continue to buy into the growth of the world's economies as an indication that things are getting better for people. Yes. Then we'll go right back here to the window.
When I think about the first question you put on the board, which was, why do we acquiesce in globalization or global economic growth if it causes all of these things? Sort of thinking particularly about these first two issues, which are sort of firm environmental or resource limits of growth. One of the things that I personally struggle with quite a bit is whether it's as Christians or Americans, how can we justify, given our wealth, which is, you know, world leading, now saying to much of the developing world or would be developing world, no, sorry, we are beyond the capacity of our planet, and therefore you can't grow the way we grew. And by the way, we grew with a much worse environmental approach than we have today because we didn't have the wealth probably to pay for it. And there's a big part of me that just wonders whether that is incredibly power egocentric and sort of conceited by us as American Christians, and therefore wrong.
Your point is an excellent point. It's an excellent point, and it's a ripping point. And I felt it in my heart, having just worked with an international group of about 15 Christians, the majority of which were Africans, around economic issues with the UN and the World Council. And that was one of the statements that they were holding up. It is not you white Americans' place to tell the African peoples not to grow. Now, these, however, it's a catch-22. It's a difficult thing because these were also very progressive people, absolutely critical of the free market, free trade and investment economy. So they were on the one hand giving the same kind of critique that I'm giving, that free trade and investment is sucking the life out of their people. But that critique has to be done, according to them, in light of what you also said, that it can't be a statement not to have growth. So what one of the Lutheran South Africans was saying, Molefe Tsele, I don't know if you know his name, was saying there are kinds of growth. And one of the qualifiers for growth is that it be pro-poor growth. In other words, that growth and poor, pro-poor, pro-job, and poor and pro-environmental growth. Mm-hmm. That we look at growth that benefits people who are poor, that we look at growth that serves the long-term environment, and that we look at growth that produces jobs. And contrary to public opinion, a lot of global corporate activity in third world countries doesn't necessarily build jobs for those people. But your point is an absolutely crucial one. The ways in which we critique growth have to be very nuanced by literally the perspectives of people teaching us what kinds of growth will serve the poor in other parts of the world. I happen to believe that one of the fundamental principles of us working our way out of this dangerous economic situation is that we now, as North American peoples, learn from voices on the underside around the globe. There is great wisdom being said and taught by African, Australian, indigenous voices that aren't in the public discourse but are laying out alternatives. And I would say that difficult nuancing of the critique of growth is one of those. So thanks for raising that point. Yes, yes.
Isn't population growth having a tremendous impact on the third world? Mexico in the last 35 years has gone from 25 million people to 100 million.
Yes.
It's got to have an unbelievable impact on the living conditions.
Yes. I firmly agree with that. That is another of the key issues that as a species we need to look at in terms of destruction of the environment and also the increasing numbers of percentages of people living in poverty. Yeah. Yes.
One of the things that kind of caused me to sit back and not react to this, I learned a lesson when I went to Nicaragua on mission trip this last year, because as Americans, I think we think, well, if we can bring freedom to people, we can have democracies, and give them opportunity, then all they have to do is pull themselves up by their bootstraps, and then it'll happen. And when we went to Nicaragua, we were in a small village up in the northwestern part of the country, and I assume these people would be fairly lazy. They're just the opposite. They're much more industrious than many, probably 99% of the people that I know, work much harder, get up much earlier, but they have absolutely no opportunity. And even if they get education, if they don't have political connections, there's no opportunity. In that country, I think it's been a series of corrupted governments that have continued to hold people back and push them down from the samosas, even now through the democracy. In democracy, you've got government ministers making $4,000 a month and teachers making $35 a month. And a pizza at the Pizza Hut is $10. You think, now who's buying that? You know, who can afford that? Well, very, very few. And it just, see, the democracy somehow there has encouraged that rather than gotten rid of it. So, I mean, but from my standpoint, it was, well, bring them democracy, bring them freedom, and they'll raise themselves up. But there's just so many things that are stacked against that, that it's almost an impossible theory.
Well, but you open up many important issues there. That's a very important comment because it raises questions about what do we mean when we say democracy. We could sit here now and spend some time, what does that term mean? And I think that, and this is all part of a bigger piece of work for me. It's part of a dissertation and it's part of a book. And one chapter of it is on the questions you've just raised. What do we mean by democracy in this country and other countries? And does democracy mean the vote? Or does it mean much, much, much more than that? Does it have to do with participation by the majority of people in decisions that shape life and death? So when we think about bringing democracy or enabling democracy in countries, it's going to behoove us all to really think, what do we mean by democracy? And what is its relationship to economic well-being? That's another set of questions. Yes, Stacy.
Are you going to be talking about efforts that Christians have taken, like I'm thinking of the Jubilee campaign?
Yeah.
And I guess my thought after what John was saying was that we take efforts to relieve debt, but at the same time, we're not helping with economic systems that support once debt is forgiven.
Uh-huh.
And so I always feel, or I get agitated by the fact that we might be taking one step forward, but sometimes we're taking five steps back at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And that the Jubilee campaign, I think, is incredible, but there aren't other systems that are supporting the work
uh-huh.
in similar manners. I don't know if you have.
Well, that wasn't on my agenda, but in response to that, that's another really important consideration. And what voices from the South, from the Global South, will say, people involved in the, you know, the Jubilee campaign? The Jubilee campaign is the campaign to cancel the debt. I see a lot of nods. So, but Stacy, what you've said is that that's not enough, that that's crucial and good and important, but not enough. And I think that's what the people who I've worked with from the South are also saying very clearly. They're saying it to Canada, they're saying it to the Jubilee committees in Europe and in Canada and the U.S. Don't stop with trying to cancel the debt. Work also towards ongoing economic restructuring that creates justice. And that's very important, which is not to minimize the importance of the work on the Jubilee campaign. Yes.
If I could follow up a little bit on the idea of government, with mm-hmm. I support his contention.
Mm-hmm.
Your illustration of how bad the schools were
yeah.
in your area.
Yeah.
Remember that in America, education is a government function.
Uh-huh.
If you know, let's hypotheticalize for a minute. Mm-hmm. If in America education was a free market
uh-huh.
economy, would not that very poor conditions of your schools long ago have been closed down and some other competitor come in and done something different and improved it? But because we see it in America, the government function, there are inequities. Because it may be the government function of your state or your city, mm-hmm. my city,
uh-huh.
10 miles apart, has a different uh-huh. role to play. So in solving the economic problem, I uh-huh. think we have to look at the role of government, what uh-huh. we think government should do,
uh-huh.
and what we think government should make
uh-huh. out of. Uh-huh. Well, boy, here's another good hot question. Is our educational problems going to be solved by privatizing or by reallocating money from the new Star Wars system to the education system? So, but that raises a whole huge bunch of questions. A response to that, I saw a hand over here, John.
Well, I mean, I think the result of that would be that the poor kids would have no school at all if you left it, because what the market does is it requires that you vote with your dollars, that you do that, and those who have no market power
yeah.
would have no right to have any.
Yeah.
Any education. It's not that some competing school
yeah.
can come in, because that's competing school to come yeah. in needs to make money.
Yeah.
It needs to make money from somebody, and yeah. those people don't have it.
Yeah. Appreciate that response. Yes, upstairs. Diane.
I think the question that's being raised with the education being an example
uh-huh.
though,
uh-huh.
about the role of government
uh-huh.
in controlling globalization
mm-hmm.
is really key, because at least what seems to me is that in this country, democracy is eroding rapidly with globalization, and that the seat of power is no longer in government, or it is shifting, you know, into a more anonymous corporate, you know, the global business structures that make decisions that totally reshape all kinds of systems. And the taking back of democracy, which was certainly one of the issues in all the WTO protests, you know, as the WTO made decisions that would override our own laws, is certainly one of the issues, whether they're environmental or other kinds of things, with very little government influence relative to the economic influences. And to me, this business about acquiescing is probably the scariest piece to me, because I, just because of that feeling of how can I affect that, at least through democratic means, I feel that there are means to influence policy and vote and agitate and all of those kinds of things. When it comes to a shift in power in an area that I've distanced myself in a variety of ways, then I think I do acquiesce because I believe I can't influence it. And when I think, in the example you gave in Nicaragua, I have friends in Guatemala that have a cooperative, a mining cooperative based on the Quiché tribe. And when we talk politics or influence the government, they want as much distance from government as possible. They believe that the only way they can exert any local power and authority is to ignore governmental influences that have been so destructive in all aspects. And so distance from government is like another aspect of globalization that to me is, if that's the public sector, it's really scary.
Well, and you're, what you just really named was one of the dynamics that I identified as a defining trend of globalization, that being the subordination of democratic political power to economic players. And I think you're right, it is a part of our disempowerment. And it is also something with which I think we can look at with great hope. We do have many civil freedoms. We do have, at least formally, freedom of speech. We have freedom to assemble. We can, as a people, decide that we want more serious democracy in our country. We want more say over life and death decisions. We don't want the WTO to make decisions. So I think there's hope in identifying a big problem. The problem that you've identified, that large economic players are making major decisions. There is truly, and I would agree with you, significant danger in that. The MAI that we talked about last week, according to one of the clauses that I didn't mention, a local government can't give priority to or any favoring to any local business over a foreign business. So Seattle couldn't say, we're giving a tax break to businesses that are started by the poorest of the poor in central Seattle. Or not tax breaks, but any other kind of break. We're not giving any break to them that we... Seattle can't say that. Seattle couldn't favor a small minority-owned or woman-owned business in any way over a mega corporation coming in from another nation, according to one of the clauses in the MAI treaty, which is just what you're saying. It means that local government is being subordinated to the workings of a large economic player. Yes.
I mean, that also, there's all sorts of other things in MAI that show that in terms of environmental interests and everything, that local government couldn't have a higher standard of water quality elsewhere. But I think the other thing in terms of government, what this shows then is that the shift is that government is no longer having as its purpose the common good. Its purpose now is basically to promote and preserve a free market economy. And anything that's, and we see that, again, speaking from Canada, for example, it's interesting now how often the Prime Minister, along with members of Parliament and premiers from various provinces, basically goes on an economic junket, mm-hmm. and along with other CEOs in that to mm-hmm. go to wherever, China, mm-hmm. Australia, mm-hmm. name it. The whole purpose of that trip mm-hmm. is government-paid, government-sponsored mm-hmm. to promote business and industry and trade. And so mm-hmm. that in many respects, the government itself is mm-hmm. simply part of the sales office of all sorts of businesses.
Okay, and Michael, that's a good point. And you're from Canada. And Canada has actually exercised worldwide leadership around these issues. Canada is one of the two countries that really spearheaded the resistance to the MAI that we talked about yesterday. I think it's important that we not have a big generic critique of government as bad guy, but critique what government is doing. And make those very critiques that you're making, but also remember at the same time that government can be many things, and we can reclaim government as servant of the public good. We can reclaim government from serving large economic interests to serving the common good if we are aware and filled with a commitment to serve the common good. And I guess, well, we need to stop. People need to be free to go. We've gone 5 minutes over. I don't want to stop the conversation ongoing, but in order to stop, I want to say a couple of things. I fear one thing a great deal, and that is that in raising these issues that are so complex and so discouraging, that inside we can all just back off a little bit more and retreat into kind of private morality, be as good as we can with our close by neighbors, be as fine as we can as individuals, and just retreat from facing this stuff. And that's why I said it's an act of courage to face these contradictions. And it's something we must do in community with like-minded people and different-minded people, not to try to do it alone, and we must do it with hope. And as Christian peoples, as for peoples in other faith traditions, but in ours, we have wonderful sources of hope. I think we're called to resistance. I think the way the global economy is going, we are called to resist and to revision and rebuild. And we have, as our faith forebearers, incredible resistors. From, you know, the way back in our scriptures, up through histories of church communities, we have people who stood against systemic injustice in marvelous ways. And I would just, as a plea, that we not retreat into our private lives and give up hope, I would just ask that we remember that we are the children of communities of resistors. People who stood up, who in some way, and as I've been studying these people, for many, it was the power of God that they believed they had the power of Jesus Christ in them to serve the common good. And I think that we are called upon to hear them. How is it that second century Christians were able to walk in the ways that they felt called, ways of neighbor love, as they understood it, even though it meant saying Jesus is Lord, which meant not only death, but death in brutal ways at the hands of the Roman Empire. They stood up to the Roman Empire because they felt that following Jesus called for that. Where did that power come from in those communities? I think that there's hope for us there. How did medieval women's communities stand up against the Roman Catholic Church in profound and subtle ways? Partly it was the power of the belief of, in some form, a union with Jesus Christ and the love and compassion of Jesus Christ. So what I'm trying to say is that we have these grandparents upon whom we can call and from whom we can learn how it is that we can claim as communities. And hear me clearly, none of these people did it as individuals. The individual as sole source of moral power is a modern fabrication. These people did it as people in communities. How did they embody Christ so fully that they could stand up to what they understood as contrary to following Jesus? So let me just say as hope that we learn from these faith forebearers ways of faithful resistance in our time and place. Thank you all for being part of the discussion.